For February the 9th, 2024, we talk about Silent Hill, The Short Message, Abathur, Grime, and much more. Welcome to Level 489. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm Jella Prendez.
And I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. Welcome back, Jella.
Wow, I'm here again. That's like a record. It's been a long time since I was on in this shortest span.
Oh, we're happy to have you. Yeah. What's going on?
Nothing.
we were talking off air. Yeah.
Good. Just, next.
Well, I mean, boring is a luxury.
Yeah.
Is what I always say, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's fine.
How about everybody else?
Yeah. Ben, how about you?
I'm in the same boat. Not much has happened in the last week. I had fish and chips and rode on a ferry over the weekend, so that was lovely.
Where'd you ride a ferry to?
Bainbridge Island is a place you can go to, and so it's normally a car ferry, but you can get on as a passenger. So I tried that for the first time over the weekend.
Nice,
cool.
Yeah. Happy birthday, Dennis!
I know.
Thank you. I got older.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good job. Which we all know only happens when you change years.
Yes.
So
yeah. it's not gradual. Yeah, you stop aging up by half years when you're 10.
Yeah, it's just like leveling up.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the portrait of Dorian Gray just incremented. Mm-hmm. You know, who can afford an entire portrait in this economy?
Yeah.
So just do little thumbnails each year.
How was it? You do anything special?
We went to a hibachi grill.
Ooh.
Over the weekend. And that was a lot of fun. That was the kiddos' first time, and they did the whole, you know, catch pieces of cucumber in your mouth and get a squirt bottle of what was sake for me. It was juice for them. Mm-hmm. And all the flipping and the tricking and all that stuff, followed by delicious food.
It's a cliche, and also the slogan for one of those restaurants, but it really is dinner and a show.
And yeah. If you've got someone that's just in a good mood, it's like very relational and intimate and fun. So kudos to them for making it a good time for us. Mm-hmm. The highlight for the kids though is the little squirt bottle they use if the flames get too big, is like a little pisser lookalike.
Oh.
And that will be talked about in our house for the rest
pisser
of eternity.
Do you mean
like the statue?
Okay. There we go. I had not heard that called that name. So
it's like the pissing pisser? Boy.
Yeah.
The pissing boy. Really?
The fountain where the water comes out of the ding dong. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was unclear. I had not heard that. So it's like the thinker, but for pissing.
Yeah.
Okay. The there we go. That's clear. Okay. So I could see how the kids would delight in that.
Absolutely, yes. So I don't think they will remember anything else about the meal in half a year. Mm-hmm. But that will be front and center in their minds.
Of course. Yeah.
I had a hibachi story. Once upon a time I went to the hibachi grill, and it was like I think my 14th birthday or something. I think that's the only time I ever went. And I just remember two things. One, that my best friend of the time came with me, but she didn't know how to use chopsticks, and so I was trying to teach her how to use chopsticks by using goldfish crackers.
Okay.
So having my friend trying, struggling, and just giving up and just like stabbing them with a chopstick in preparation for this special event. And then the other thing I remember is that we were across the table from an Australian couple, and the dude kept on flicking peas across the grill at us.
What?
That's it.
That's not all. Okay.
Yeah. So those are my memories of the hibachi grill. So, yeah. At least your boys have something else that's interesting.
Yes.
My favorite version of the hibachi experience is Mongolian barbecue, where you go and you get like the everything that you want in your dish, and then you and then you hand it to them like it's a challenge. Like, cook this, you piece of shit. Yeah. It always...
That you've never seen anyone fill this much up before.
Yeah, yeah. And then they cook it, and you're stuck with it because ultimately you made it. Yeah, it was your choices. Yeah,
they always get you with it. It's like one bowl is $15, two bowls is $20, unlimited bowls is $21.
Yes,
and you go for unlimited, and then you can't even get through the first.
No,
bowl.
No, you get through maybe one bowl. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh well. Well, that sounds fun.
Yeah.
Happy
it
birthday!
It was delightful. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I really don't have much going on either. This is going to be a quick little intro section. My rock band's drum kit broke.
Oh no.
Yeah. Aww. Yeah. Like it's annoying too, because it's not just the, like it's not a like an important part ... if you don't mind not using your cymbals. So I use the pro kit, and like the plastic part that the cymbal bolts onto on top of the rod there, that snapped. Plastic degrades, you know, it's this drum kit is 14 years old at this point. It was going to happen sooner or later. So now I am in the valley of trying to figure out how to possibly mend this or 3D print a replacement part, anything to not have to buy a rock band instrument in 2024, because I don't know if you've looked, but shit's popping off. It's wild out there. Yeah.
It's all like secondhand, I imagine. Right?
Oh yeah. It's secondhand, and every individual item is, you know, rarer than Picasso's. Yeah, it's
the person you're buying from probably killed someone to get it.
Right, right. They've been mostly inheritances at this point. So that's been my bummer thing for today. So, oh well, I could play without the cymbals, but I don't know, man. I don't want to go back to that. Come on.
I mean, this sounds like a project. So this sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I found a design for a 3D printed replacement part. I just have to, my county's library doesn't have a 3D printer. So I have to get a library card for like two counties over to get it. Cause yeah. Oh, well, yeah. I mean, no sense belaboring it. That was our banter. Why don't we talk about the video games we've been playing by doing a regular kind of show? What would the grind, the multiplayer, and the end boss? And we can get started with
the grind.
The grind, where we talk about the games we have been playing over the last period of time or so. Jala, you weren't here last week, so I'll go to you first.
Okay, so I have several demos and one other title. So I will talk about the one title first, and then we'll go into demo land. So the one thing that I was playing was Monster Prom. It's a 2018 multiplayer dating sim developed by Beautiful Glitch, a Barcelona-based studio. There is a DLC for it called Monster Prom Second Term. I co-opted this with Ryzana, my Dave, and then Moxie. So in this game, you play one of four students that are attending Spooky Academy, seeking to romance one of six different romanceable characters. And you can choose either a short game, which is 1.5 hours, or a full game, which is 2 hours. When you start, you answer a bunch of different questions that affect how your stats come out. So like your starting stats are like a baseline, but then depending upon how you answer these certain questions, you get different, you know, alterations to those stats. And the gameplay revolves around how you choose to spend your time at school over the course of 6 weeks that are leading up to prom. So going to different places in the school will affect your stat growth, which in turn affects how successful you are at different actions you can try to take during the course of the game, like when different events happen. Mm-hmm. So say you go to the outside, which is where you raise your fun stat. And then the randomized story bit that takes place there leaves you with two options, one of which you're thinking probably relates to your low smart score, right? You happen to have a low smart score, and it's, you know, this one you think is probably the smarts category. Mm-hmm. The other one you think relates to your fun score. You don't actually know for a fact because it doesn't tell you anywhere, but you can just kind of, you know, guess. Mm-hmm. So anyway, since you have a high fun score, you decide that you're going to go with, you know, the fun option, and, you know, you pass the check or whatever, the stat check. And then, you know, like you get extra bonuses from, you know, winning that particular thing, you know, being successful at that particular action or suggestion. You can also potentially gain hearts with some of the different romanceable characters, whoever happens to be there at the time, depending upon, you know, how that all plays out. If you happen to fail, then you actually get a penalty to your stats. So at one point, I think Rizana had like 20 fun and then like -4 and I don't know, charisma or something like that. I don't remember which one it was. Some other stat was like -4. So, you know, like that's how that game rolls. And that just means that, like, if that's an option to use that stat that's -4, there's no way.
Yeah, no way.
That that's going to be passed, right? So at the end of each of the different turns, if there are multiple players, you can randomize the turn order. And once one character goes somewhere, no other characters can go there. That area is basically spent and, you know, out of play. So, like, if I go to class, nobody else can go to class that time.
Yeah.
How do the checks work? Do they tell you, or is it like a hidden check?
It's a hidden check. So, like, you have, you know, there's always two options. You don't have any more than that. There's two different options to where you can resolve a problem or, you know, offer a suggestion when two characters are having a fight or whatever. And depending upon like how it reads, you can kind of guess which one is going to be what, you know, but it doesn't tell you anywhere what that check is. And it isn't an invisible check. And then it just has like a little icon that pops up right as soon as you select your option that kind of tells you whether you've passed or failed.
Okay. Is there any differentiation? Like this is like a light fun check versus this is like a hard fun check, that sort of thing, or?
Not that I can tell. I've only played through it the one time so far. So like, I don't know if there's like, you know, different types of fun checks or anything like that. I do know that there are multiple games in the series. So there's Monster Prom, there's Monster Prom 2, and then there's Monster Prom 3 Road Trip. And that last one is actually more of a co-op one, where instead of everybody having individual stats, you have like one group stat that you're like a stat pool that you're trying to build up. So it's co-op rather than, I guess, sort of versus. I mean, you know, it's not necessarily versus, because like, unless you're vying for the exact same person that you want to date, but you know,
it sounds like an expansion of the Yogg. Really.
It is.
Yeah,
it is. It runs kind of like that. That's something that Rizana mentioned when we were playing. So, yeah. And at the end of the 6 weeks, you can select who you want to ask to prom, and multiple people can ask the same character out, but that character is only going to pick the person with the most favor or the highest score in their relevant stat or something like that. I think it goes by the favor first, and if there's a tie, then they go with the higher stat.
Yeah. So
the writing,
it sounds like it's got a lot of DNA with Doomsday Paradise as well.
Doomsday Paradise. I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's a recent indie game. I'm guessing. I think it's later than 2018. So it's probably better to say that Doomsday Paradise has a lot of DNA of this.
Yes.
Yeah, so the writing for this is really off the wall and pretty funny. And Rizana, who has played through all of these at least once or twice, tells me that the writing continues to improve as the series progresses. So there are a bunch of different endings, and there's a lot of different secret stuff, like different paths you can unlock. You get to learn a lot of different things about all of the romanceable characters and stuff. And so, like, it does encourage replay for that reason, because you get to learn more about all these different characters. And it's the same characters that are in the second and third game as well. So you have a lot of time with these characters over the course of these different games. And yeah, so it was fun. It was a nice, fun time. I will let you all know that I did successfully date the ghost Polly.
Okay. As opposed to a Polly ghost.
Correct.
Okay.
So, I think it's like Polly Geist or something like that is how her name, her full name goes. Something like that. I don't know. Anyway, but yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything else to say about it. It was fun. It's a cute little, very relaxing, chill co-op type of experience.
Yeah.
So...
Look, is it a game where everyone needs to own a copy of it, or can you get by with just one person?
So the way that we did it is we were on my Discord server, and basically Rezana just did a screen share and then let everybody pick and then just did all of the things, you know, as like a local.
Gotcha. So. Yeah. This doesn't work like I thought it did. Based on looking at the remit of it, I thought it was you were playing a multiplayer game and the players were like doing role play romancing with each other. Mm. The way this lays out is less off-putting to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually a fun little game. Like it's not like, and even though it's a dating sim, it's not like, it doesn't go into the realm of like skeevy dating sim. It's just like cute and fun. It's just
like a little social sim kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
nice.
Well, yeah. Any questions about Monster Prom?
No, it sounds like a good time.
Yeah, it is. It's a fun game. So, the next thing I'll talk about is Abathur. So Abathur, I played two different demos for it. I found out about this game because the dev followed me on Blue Sky, and I was like, what is this? And I looked at it, and then I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I want to play this. It's a 2D action platformer with roguelite elements, and it's supposed to be coming out, I think, third quarter of this year. Mm-hmm. So the announcement trailer for the PS5 and Switch versions came out a week ago, so they finally just, like, announced it on different platforms and everything. Nice. Pickle Factory tells me that it looks a lot like Rostun. I don't know what that game is. I never played that.
It's giving Rostun kind of vibes. Old arcade game. Also, like the way that the guy moves or the holds the sword, it looks very similar to like the platforming sections of ActRaiser as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. The way that it plays and feels when you've got it in your hands is kind of like a cross between Castlevania and Golden Axe. Mm-hmm. So it is going to allow for 4-player local and online capacity once it releases. But the demos are, I think, local co-op only.
Yeah.
Since I was playing on Steam Deck, I played by myself because I wasn't going to try to figure that out with Dave. So.
Yeah. Gorgeous pixel art on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's got 40 different tracks of music, and the final game is going to have 50 levels in it.
Wow.
So I played both Atlantis Landing, which is the first iteration of the demo, as well as the Abathur, just the name Abathur demo, which is the newer of the two and has a few changes. So in the newer demo, there's checkpoints at the end of each level. Originally, you offered your money and received power-ups. In the new version, you offer up souls of the monsters you kill and receive money, which is added to what you pick up in the level, and then that can be spent at a merchant. So that merchant wasn't in the first iteration. So basically they're adding polish and extra stuff on there that wasn't in the original demo. So if folks think this sounds cool, try the Abathur just plain name demo. That demo is the same as the Atlantis Landing one, except it has a little bit more polish on it.
Yeah. That's the one that that's on Steam, it looks like.
Yeah, yeah. And both demos cover 5 levels from the game. It's the exact same levels in both of those two demos, so don't think that you're playing anything different there. Mm-hmm. And since it is 4-player, that means there's 4 characters to choose from that all have different stats. Mm-hmm. There's a barbarian guy who's basically your Mario equivalent with kind of average stats all around, a Valkyrie with high defense, a thief with high agility, and a sorcerer that has a sword that has, I guess, your magic power.
It's almost literally the gauntlet stable. Yeah.
Uh-huh. It is. It is. So each of them has a special move. Like, you have a regular attack, a dash, a special move. You can also pick up items, and those items can either be healing items or special secondary weapons like knives or spears or something. Mm-hmm. So the barbarian special move is a 360 sword slice that kind of goes arcs over his head. Valkyrie's special move is she has a shield.
Valkyrie's special move is invested in equipment.
Yes. Yeah. Rogue gets to do like basically an uppercut, like a rising sword slash, and then the sorcerer uses a multi-hit burst of magic. So there's a lot of secrets and traps and power-ups and so on. At the end of every level, like I mentioned, you do a soul offering to the gods. So the plot in this game, I know this is like, you know, a little beat-em-up gauntlet thing. Nobody cares too much about the plot. I thought it was actually kind of cool. The Atlantean civilization has angered the gods, who have sent hordes of monsters to punish Atlantis, and the player characters have come to save it, traversing the continent and delving into the lore, which is based on Plato's writings and Athanasius's map. So, like, they actually are history nerds who decided that they were going to make a game centered around some of the stuff that Plato wrote about Atlantis, which is pretty cool. Instead of just making it up 100% off the cuff, they're actually going off of a source. So that's neat.
Yeah.
And there's collector's editions available right now for PS5 and Switch, and it looks really cool. I'm definitely going to be picking up a copy when it goes live.
Looks pretty neat. I mean, even just from a production kind of standpoint, I love when you know, you get the, you know, kind of the commitment to these incredibly large sprites on a screen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say that even though it has like the nostalgic old kind of Golden Axe era vibe to it, it also has some really nice, like nice, clean, big boss sprites and things like that, and nice, smooth animations and things as well. Like it has some of the nostalgia factor, but without being 100%, we're just going to work within only that style. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it doesn't look like disjointed or anything.
Yeah. No, so, seems cool.
Yeah. So I played two more demos and I have less to say about those. So that'll be nice and quick. So the next one is Raw Metal, which is a stylish stealth action dungeon crawler game by Team Crucible, which releases March 19th. So that's just a little bit over a month away. And in this game, you are infiltrating the depths of an exoplanet mining facility to scavenge for gear and challenge a corrupt megacorporation. I'm down for all of that. So like it's overhead, top down looking while you sneak around each level. And then once you get into a combat setting, then it's like right up in your face, you know, and you get to do like a bunch of different combos and you can juggle enemies in the air and all different kinds of stuff like that. So then it gets into like the more action style play.
Looks like Lethal Gear Company.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. But yeah, it's very, very stylish. And then like when you pull off really cool finishers and stuff, like it goes to this side pan where it flattens out and has like these fancy colors and has like a compliment in the background, like nice or raw or whatever, as the slow-mo camera, you know, lets the enemy fall away from you. So it looks really neat. Stylish action games are not things that I like to play, generally speaking. No. My hand gets tired.
Yeah, a lot of tappa. I'm
usually too tired to deal with it.
A lot of tappa.
But yeah, it's a lot of tappa. But this one looks really fun. I will at least pick it up and fuddle around with it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, any questions about that?
No, I hadn't heard about this. Cool. Is it multiplayer or is it just a single player?
Single player,
not just a single player, but yeah,
I believe.
Yeah,
it's a lowly single player game.
Yeah, the last one that I played, the last demo, was Crow Country. This is by SFB Games. Imagine Final Fantasy VII Dorito Men PS1 graphics with Resident Evil style gameplay and musical cues from Silent Hill.
I'm listening.
Yeah, so it's 1990 and you play as Mara Forrest, an investigator, come to a theme park 2 years after the disappearance of the owner. You're there seeking answers and very quickly find yourself fighting zombies and monsters and stuff like that in a creepy spot, creepy place. Kind of looks, to me, it looks like Lego people, but Dave's like, no, that looks like the Final Fantasy Dorito Man. I'm like, okay. Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
That's what I said.
Yeah, basically, it's the same thing. You know, okay. You know, it the differentiation exists in someone's mind. So whatever that looks like to you, more power to you. Mm-hmm. But
this looks rad.
I played a little bit of it. It is pretty neat. It's hitting all the beats. It's definitely drawing from the source materials I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually got a couple of parts where I was focused on what I was doing, and then there's like a loud sound, and I'm like, oh, like, you know, it might jump scare you a little bit, even though like it doesn't look like a game that would be able to jump scare you.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
you know, but I'm looking forward to playing more of it.
No, I had no idea about this, and this is immediately on my radar. Mm-hmm. Yeah, looks like it'd be perfect for streaming here. It's emulating an era of the PlayStation One that you don't see. Pulled from especially very much. There's a lot of like super early PS1, but like this kind of like higher fidelity, but still kind of chunkity looking, like roughly Final Fantasy IX time period. Let's say late PS1. You just kind of don't see that too much. And I'm excited to see somebody take a whack at it.
Yeah, because that's why I was like, it doesn't look quite as blocky as like a Final Fantasy VII does.
Yeah.
But, you know, like whatever reference works for you, you know. But so these are ones that I definitely had a lot of fun with. Like I played three demos and all three of them were hits. That's cool because that doesn't usually happen.
Yeah. Nice.
I have some more demos that I will be playing in the near future. So
keep an eye on what's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Are you finding them anywhere in particular, or is this just happens to be that you stumbled across a bunch of demos?
Well, Abathur is because the dev followed me on Blue Sky, and then in Discord chat in my server, everybody was talking about the Steam Next Fest. And so people were tossing around articles and things. And when I was looking through one of those articles, The Crow Country and Raw Metal both of those were in one of those articles, along with like, I don't know, 20 other titles. But those are the ones I picked out to try.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I did not realize it was Next Fest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's why I say I have a few more demos I'll be playing. The next time I'm on, I'll have those to talk about, because it's demos and other short turnaround types of things, and then like assignment play. So.
I'm going to go because I have something new.
Cool.
Ooh. Yeah. Over the weekend on Saturday, I played Silent Hill: The Short Message.
This is what I have this week as well.
Okay. Yeah. So we can
tag team it. We can
tag team it. This is a baffling product from a where does this fit into any kind of like release strategy kind of point of view. This was announced and released at the same time during a Sony streaming, what do they call their state of play addresses or whatever?
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, here's this like little 2-hour first person Silent Hill story that you can play right now. Also, it's the first playable non-Silent Hill Ascension thing to release in 12 years. Bye. I went in with basically no expectations other than what I saw at that event, that this is a story about a young woman in high school who is struggling with self-harm ideation and is kind of trapped in this loop, going through this abandoned apartment building looking for her friend who is an artist. It's a 2-hour game that is almost entirely narrative, so it is difficult to talk about it without revealing too much of what goes on. There's been a lot of discourse around it as well, as regards the ending and the way that it does or does not treat the topic of self-harm. It's hard for me to speak to that an awful lot. I generally liked it. I want to know how you feel, Ben. How did you leave this?
I'm glad that they're making Silent Hill games. The thought that I came to when I was playing this is, like in comedy, if you're making a joke about something that's somewhat of a sensitive like subject matter, you better make sure that you have a good understanding of the content and that mm-hmm. you, and that the joke is like really good, that sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking it's like the same sort of thing with a game where it's like, if you want to talk about like serious matters like this, it's like, you better be kind of sensitive around it. Mm-hmm. It's like one of those things where it's like, I'm kind of on the outside, you know, cause a lot of it's with respect to like social media addiction is kind of more aimed towards like a younger generation perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But for me, the game kind of lacked like all of the subtlety that like previous entries did, where like thinking specifically of Silent Hill 3, where it's like, the main character of that is going through a lot of like similar issues that the main character in this is going through, mm-hmm. but you have to like lean in and kind of, think about the game in order to like uncover that. Whereas like here, it's a lot of like tell, don't show instead of show, don't tell.
Yeah. It's certainly more talky than I want a Silent Hill game to be. So much of the mystique of the older ones was the complete unreactiveness of the protagonist as they mm-hmm. as they looked at and encountered stuff, you know,
and yeah, and like the dreamlike state of everything.
Yeah. And here you have the main character, I think Anita is her name, yes. kind of commenting on stuff, and yeah, it is a bit of a bummer how much of it is kind of out there on the kind of out there on the front. On the other side, I almost wonder if a more subtle approach would have come across as being maybe a little bit a little bit too vague on whether or not what they're depicting is, for lack of a better word, good. You know, it's like, okay, when you're talking about teen suicide, you kind of want to make it clear, right?
Yeah.
And from that standpoint, like a lot of what happens and a lot of the journey that goes there is very much like textbook, like this is what somebody who is thinking about harming themselves is going through at this point, and here are ways to, you know, interrupt that and stop mm-hmm. their mind from lying to them, you know, kind of thing.
I guess
good.
Okay. The thing I was a little bit disappointed in is it's like, it's almost like it's like a showcase of like different types of like traumas that one can go through, but it felt somewhat unearned because it would just be like, here's like a terrible experience someone's had. Here's another terrible experience somebody's had or something like that.
Yeah.
Where it's like, and perhaps it's a product of the fact that it's only a 2-hour game and that, you know, like there's not time to like do more slow development. But I do want to say some like positive things about the game and not just like be completely negative on it.
Mm-hmm.
I do appreciate the fact that they're trying to make like a new Silent Hill and like kind of recontextualize things. So is it okay if we move on and talk about like non-narrative parts of the game? Or
I'll toss a thought that, yeah, just before we move away from the topic, you mentioned that it feels like this is kind of aimed at a younger generation. And it's so interesting to me kind of thinking about it in that context of, you know, the older generations, there's a knife in your inventory and there's never any comment on what it might mean for how often you look at it, except maybe you kind of figure out way later that it shows up at the end of the game, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the young generation, it's like, wow, if I am even at the beginning of realizing that I might be having self-harm thoughts, I immediately turn it into a TikTok and post it out to all my friends.
Yeah.
This could be worth some clout. Like this, that's speaking in very broad stereotypical strokes, but I see the possible thought in a generationally different way of approaching trauma.
So this kind of deals with that to a certain degree about, maybe somebody giving a cry for help through the way that they present themselves that people don't necessarily pay attention to until it's too late. There are people like it's frustrating to read about this because there are people who just are outright rejecting it because it's a story about teen girls, which is ridiculous given what Silent Hill 3 was about. And also like how good Silent Hill Shattered Memories was as well, which, you know, was also, you were following in the footsteps of Cheryl and learning about how, kind of troubled and disappointing her younger, you know, or just her life was up to, you know, what she was going through. Like Silent Hill has actually like been focused on youth before. So that criticism doesn't make a ton of sense around it. I don't want to accuse anybody specifically of it, but there was what seemed to be a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to just rejecting something that was about teen girls.
This is a question of me not being familiar with those games, but did the earlier games that featured young female protagonists like present them primarily as I'm in distress because I'm a young female protagonist instead of having other, you know, more complex issues going on?
And, you know, had to do with peer rejection and things like that. And that's not what this does either. It's not, I am, oh boy, it's real hard being a young woman. It's right. a little bit more textured than that. And by a little bit, I mean, greatly.
So it's more to the reactionary moment that we're in that people are,
I think people go online and say just about anything.
Yeah.
Yep. So some thoughts around that I had was I thought it would have been better the example you gave with like the knife and looking at the knife, if like they gave you control of like the phone that you have during this game and like allow you to post things and like some sort of choice of like, you know, put you in the shoes of like what you want to post if you're trying to like farm likes and stuff like that and give a more like subjective experience. Like it's like I think that would be like a good way to go if you're trying to get the sort of narrative across to the player.
Yeah.
But sure. Again, it could just be that this is just a limited in scope game and they just didn't have the time or effort to do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I did want to say, I like the fact that they recontextualize like what the Silent World or Silent Hill world is like when things go dark or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that they tried a kind of a different approach than like what they had done in the past. Like that's good that, you know, trying to do something like more creative than that.
Yeah.
I
can't help but think about how much harder the visual design of this would have hit if those key art images weren't leaked before, because for some news story a couple of years back, we had talked about like, hey, this you know, like what seems to be art for a new Silent Hill game, kind of featuring you know, a humanoid monster kind of covered in cherry blossoms, and also, you know, some of this art of, you know, every surface in a room being covered with like post-it notes paper. That have you know, something hateful written on them. Like just like, oh my gosh, like what is this? That this is what that was from. I feel like a little bit of the impact was deadened by the fact that I had seen some of that stuff before, because like, you know, even knowing that something like that was coming, it still hits very hard the way that it is presented here. The visual design in this is top notch to me.
Also, I had forgotten all about that. So yep. I was, I guess I was surprised. And also the setting was unique too. It took place in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But the characters, I think are mostly like Asian, but I don't know if it's like first generation or I don't know.
It's like this special, like the city that it takes place in is in this German borderland. And it's an economic development zone that was heavily invested in by the Chinese. And then they pulled out, kind of leading to it being incredibly blighted. Kind of like causing a lot of like economic circumstances for the characters who are kind of dwelled on. So yeah,
and I think there's also a detail too that like the Japanese company tried to revitalize the town twice and failed. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So I like the fact that they're in creative decisions. I learned a lot more about this game afterwards by going to the Wikipedia page and basically just reading an interview of like one of the creators, where this is kind of like the Artemis project at NASA, where they're like, we haven't made a Silent Hill game in a long time, so we just want to make sure we still can. So we're going to release this game.
We don't trust these bozos over at Blooper Team. So,
yeah. So it was like a joint project with, it's like a Japanese game developer. I forget what other game they've done. It's like Rez or something like that.
I forget. So I don't know. It was a joint development. The writer on it is Ryukishi 07. The author behind the When They Cry series, Higurashi and Umineko. which are horror suspense themed visual novels that are really highly esteemed that also deal with similar subject matter to this one. I'm not sure about who the gameplay developer is on it though.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, it's joint where they used people in-house at Konami who were interested in the game and like developing on the game. Mm-hmm. And they kind of did a joint venture between those two groups of people. Mm-hmm. So it was basically like a passion project, I think it's a good move as far as like releasing it for free, mm-hmm. as opposed to like trying to sell this for, I don't, if you were to put a price on this, I'm not sure what would be a reasonable price. Like, yeah. $5 or $10 maybe, or
I mean, I've seen slider projects released for like $15-$20. So,
sure, yeah. Sure. I guess one other thing I wanted to mention, like the main gameplay is, or like one of the main gameplays of the Nightmare World is there's like a monster you need to run away from. I was somewhat disappointed with that, where I felt like it was, too easy to fail and have to like restart. And like, basically there's only one sort of gimmick, which is whatever direction the monster come from, you need to find a circle in the path,
yeah.
and like kite it around that and then go to where they came from, mm-hmm. as a way to get out.
The instant fail pursuit stuff is a real bummer, especially yeah. mixed in. I mean, this is probably worth warning people about. Like, the final big gameplay challenge in this is an extended chase sequence where you have to navigate an entire floor of this apartment building looking mm-hmm. for five very specific collectibles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this monster is chasing you the entire time. It is such a difficulty spike that I would not blame anybody for quitting when they get to that point. And it could be fixed so easily, either by making it so it wasn't instant death. Maybe you were, you know, you get caught and then get caught again, or unforgivably, you're going and like looking for these five doodads. It does not checkpoint between the doodads. You do not like, you do not respawn and like, oh, you already got this one that's over in the, you know, the shopping cart full of baby heads zone. You've got to go and get back there when the layout is already confusing before you take in mind that you are constantly running to stay ahead of this thing that's chasing you. It trips over its dick at the last moment.
The other thing I wanted to point out too is there's kind of a new way that they did cutscenes in the game where they have live action video. Mm-hmm. It kind of made me wonder if they're taking a page from like the Remedy type gameplay.
Yeah, Alan Wake, something like that.
Yeah, trying to integrate like video and video game together. So that was like a bit surprising.
It's good. It's an uncanny effect, especially with the like the dubbing that's done. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, man, that's just a factor of localization. It's not like it's intentional, but the effect yeah. of, you know, the voice not quite matching, you know, what you see, you know, does distance you from it in a way mm-hmm. that is really useful for what they're trying to depict about these people that they're showing.
Do they yeah. use any actors that are more well known?
No, just young girls.
I don't know. So overall, kind of mixed feelings about it, where it's hard to feel upset about playing a free game. So
yeah,
shrug. But, there's definitely good ideas that I can go forward with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I came away from it, and just the more that I've thought about it, I'm like, yeah, I don't want everything to be like this. Like this is still very much in line with, PT. Which I think yeah. is a well that they may have dug, but other people have just pumped it dry. Like there's no more corn on that cob, right? Yeah. So yeah, it's a bummer that it is as kind of derivative of PT as it is. But like, I don't know, based on the fact that this is like a trial to see if they can. I enjoy it, and you know, the lack of subtlety, the kind of the analogy that I came up with on stream was, you know, the song by REM, Everybody Hurts. Mm-hmm. You know, it is incredibly maudlin, very over the top. There's no subtlety to it at all, and the band knows it, right? Like, just like, hey, yeah, but like, I don't know if like maybe if one person hears this and rethinks what they're going through and rethinks what they're going to do, then well, that is this art serving its purpose. And that's kind of how I feel about this as like a message game, you know, on top of everything else, you know, in playing with this, you know, and what I don't want to do is fall into a trap where I mistake lack of subtlety for lack of artfulness. So it's kind of me, you know, tempering a little bit of my reaction to the lack of subtlety. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A jaded mind can find a reason to dismiss any attempt to talk about, you know, heavier subject material in a helpful light.
Yeah. So it's cool. Any questions? Final thoughts?
Nope. So would you like to see Silent Hill go more towards these bite-size, I don't know if episodic is the right word, kind of games? Or are you like, okay, that was a nice diversion, now give me a full Silent Hill?
Obviously, you are not a Silent Hill fan, because if you were, you would understand that having any hopes, desires, expectations, that's not part of this game. You do not say what you would like, because nobody is listening. Nobody will come to help you. You just accept what is coming.
You are so right.
Everybody hurts sometimes.
Oh man. I've got one other short thing. Just to check in on it. So last week I talked about finishing up Final Fantasy VII Remake, the main game of that. And in the meantime, I have also played and finished the DLC mission for that. Intermission is what it is, released as part of the Final Fantasy VII Remake Intergrade Collection, if you're buying that now. This is a side story starring the teenage ninja character from Final Fantasy VII, Yuffie. You're playing as her on a mission, heading into Midgar, trying to steal like this piece of ultimate materia, you know, magical stone, basically, that that she had heard about them developing. You know, she's an agent of Wutai, this kind of Japan analogous nation that is in this long war with Shinra and Midgar and all of that. And you are this operative who is sneaking in and working with, you know, people inside the city, you know, the terrorist group Avalanche, trying to get yourself in there. This is very short. I beat it in about 5 hours, probably, based on that. You can do more because they have like almost like a weird little Gwent kind of thing going on with it, like a little side game you can play called Fort Condor, which is pulled from and very similar to a little strategy game that was in Final Fantasy VII as well in the original. But like, this is like a little wargaming miniature game that you can play, that people, you know, the craze is sweeping. Midgar, you know, people are collecting these little toys and playing games with each other. It's fine as far as these things go. Nothing will ever beat Triple Triad, to the point where it's actually it is actually unfair of me to hold anything to the standard that Final Fantasy VIII set with Triple Triad. So I didn't spend an awful lot of time with that, and that's where more people would I think sink some hours into it. Combat in this is good. You are only playing as and controlling Yuffie. But she is interesting from a mechanical perspective because her weapon is this big shuriken kind of thing, which can either be like a, you know, wielded like a dagger up close, or you can throw it at range and then cast like ninja spells to, you know, to deal damage at range. And the encounters are kind of designed for this quickly switching back and forth between those. Overall, this kind of left me a little bit cold. Just because it is so slight, it also takes place like in the middle, like in between some chapters of Final Fantasy VII itself, and doesn't have an awful lot to do with anything really. It's a bit of a Shaggy Dog story, and that nothing that happens advances, you know, like an overall plot, other than and everybody is going to be happy about this because we were all clamoring for bringing Final Fantasy Dirge of Cerberus character and canon into the main lore, baby. You remember Dirge of Cerberus, the PlayStation 2 third-person shooter that Square made, where you played as Vincent Valentine, and it was after Final Fantasy VII, and everybody cared about it a lot.
Well, sorry, you're going to have to say, it's got to be a connection thing. I keep getting bursts of static when you mention any proper nouns in there.
Yeah, you end up going up against who would eventually be the Shinra, like, splinter cell group of biological, weirdo mechanical Sephiroths that are there, which is underwhelming, to say the least. I don't care about these goobers. But it's fine. It's more Final Fantasy VII remake. I would probably have been more receptive to this if, like everybody else, I had played the original on release and then waited 6 months for this. It probably would have been time. Mm. Playing it back to back, though, like so many things, ends up being a little bit of it just kind of feels like extraneous and is staying past its welcome a little bit.
I wonder if that was something that they were originally going to put in the game and then they cut it. But then they're like, hey, we could use this as a little.
Oh, yeah. That's possible. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. So we'll see. I've got no idea if he's even playable in Rebirth. So if those plots are going to connect, I know that there was just a big event. Sony did another one and there's a demo out for it. I'm just going to wait for the full release for that. But yeah, that's my thoughts on Intermission.
Cool.
Let's see. Ben, did you have anything besides Silent Hill Short Message?
I just got a tiny Resident Evil 4 VR update. I'm in the castle. That's about it. I got a shotgun and a rifle now, so it's great.
More sniping at that point, right?
Yeah, so that is like a new mechanic that I hadn't seen before, where when you get a rifle, when you get a scope to it, if you hold it up to your eye, it'll change the screen on that eyeball to be like a zoomed in version. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of cool mechanic. Yeah. And so you literally like have to shut your one eye and like aim down the scope sort of thing. So nice. That's pretty fun. But yeah, it's good to play this game knowing what's coming up, so that you can do more planning and not get too overwhelmed by it. Yeah. But so far so good. It continues to be a really good VR experience.
How is the Higante fight? In that, either the one in the village or the one in the one in the castle toward the beginning.
Yeah, it went pretty well. I think it kind of speaks to how well the game is like giving you ammo when you need it and adjusting to wherever you're at. So I never ran out or anything like that. And the one detail I didn't notice is like when the part where you jump on the back and start slashing the virus part of it, mm-hmm. like you're literally doing that in first person. And the virus thing has like a little tiny face on the end of it with little tiny teeth. Aww. And stuff like that, which I never really noticed playing the game regular. So that's a disturbing and fun fact that was learned. But yeah, that was good. The fight with the twin chainsaw women, that went okay. I was not like, terrified or anything. Yeah. I think that's the general thing that is good about it, is points that I think I would be like very terrified to experience it in VR is actually goes pretty okay. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel overwhelmed. Nice. So you just lob those grenades when you get in trouble and it works out okay. So it's pretty good.
Nice. You're getting more some more stuff for PSVR too. They announced that new Stalker game. Metro 2033.
Oh, yeah, which I saw a preview for that.
That's
a
really good fit for VR, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
We'll see. Mm-hmm. I'm taking it one game at a time, so try not to be greedy.
Yeah. I think after you bought that headset, you can be a little greedy if you want as a treat.
Yeah.
Dennis.
That's all I got.
Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, I'll do another stop on the quick check-in circuit. I am continuing to play Diablo 4 Hardcore, and my sorcerer, Willem Dafoe, has reached level 76.
Willem's still kicking
which notably,
it. Woohoo!
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Reached level 76, which notably is the highest level I have reached with any character, hardcore or non, in the game. And then he promptly died to a controller disconnect.
What?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So I play with a PS4 controller like plugged in to the PC. And I as near as I can tell, it was something with the wire where it just controller shut down. I could not get to the keyboard fast enough to save poor Willem, and he is no more.
Can you write a letter to get Willem respond?
Oh, no. Every time you create a hardcore character, you have to agree to a little statement. It's like, I understand that when this character dies, no matter the reason, there is no way to get it back.
But I mean, is there another checkbox at the bottom that says, come on,
come on, and then after Will Defoe and everything. No, it's fine. I started a new character, and already am into world tier 3. So that's, you know, that's a major step into getting back to where I was. It is really funny how each time through I'm getting better and faster at leveling up. So it almost becomes a race. It's like, okay, I got to 76 last time. Let's see how fast I can get back to it now. Mm-hmm. Which is leading me to play riskier than I otherwise would. Mm-hmm. And that's probably working against me. But so far, the next sorcerer, Garbledina, so sorceress, I should say, is doing just fine. And yeah, that continues to be a fun game to play as a run-based, hack and slash 'em simulator.
Hmm. Nice.
Yeah, so that's Diablo 4. And then I have continued to play Grime as well.
Yeah, I want to hear about this.
So this one... Yes, this one is exclusively on Steam Deck. Which, by the way, when you play Diablo 4 on Steam Deck, there's no chance of your controller disconnecting.
No, so but the battery might run out.
Steam Deck.
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Yeah. Well, if you're plugged in, you're all right. Mm. Unless you plug in and don't realize that you didn't plug in far enough and then it shuts down on you. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
No. The world is a nightmare of risk.
Yes. And that's the way I like it, baby. So playing Grime, continues to be some excellent side scrolling, Souls-like-esque action. And, I have recently gone beyond the outer gate of the main town,
mm-hmm.
Which is really funny because that is not that far from the last, time I talked about it. I imagine if you're following the story of this game linearly, see, what happened was I got the instructions, the like main guy told me something about, I can let you through the gate, but there's this thing down under the castle that has something and you need to go get that for me.
Mm-hmm.
What he meant was I opened the gate, go through the gate and then go get the thing.
Oh,
what I understood was I will open the gate when you go get that.
Yeah. Okay. So
I didn't even go back and check the gate.
How many new areas did you find heading down into the left?
So many there are freaking new areas. Yeah. What in the world?
Yeah. They take a note from Soft, and they hide very major stuff behind things that you would be very improbable to find on your own, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All you need to do is misunderstand the main quest giver's instructions, apparently. Yeah. And that'll do you just fine. I have explored so much, and like it never occurred to me to go back and check the gate because I was consistently finding new areas, mm-hmm. and making progress through new things, yeah. going the wrong direction.
And that's late game shit that you find down there. Like
it got dicey. So I got to a point where literally every path available to me, I did not have the moveset to get through.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think there's like a little like black hole ball kind of thing. And I think at some point, if you dash into it, it will like reset your dash in the air.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the way all the areas are set up, but I don't have the ability to do that yet. And so I beat literally the Giant of Eyes is down there. And there's a reason I felt like that boss was so hard is because it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I explored everything and hit basically all the walls or all the places where it was evident I needed a power I didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And only then did I go back up to upgrade my weapon.
No.
And accidentally chose, I had gone back a couple times to upgrade my weapon, but I chose listen instead of upgrade on accident. Like they're next to each other in the menu. And going through his dialogue again, I'm like, oh shit.
Yeah, there's actually a much easier way to go through the big door here.
Yeah. Which is hilarious, because then you jump into this new area, and I've done all this leveling up and you know, very difficult stuff in these, you know, nether regions of the game, that I'm crushing my way through this next area that I found.
Yeah.
But you know, I can honestly say, like, that was a week well spent, you know, playing, I you know, or however long in game time that was. I enjoyed myself thoroughly playing it, even though I didn't know what the right way forward was. I kept on finding interesting stuff around every corner. Yeah. And man, it doesn't get better than that.
It's a really good game.
You weren't lying. No. Despite my assertions in the beginning.
I would have no reason to. That's a weird thing for you to think I would lie about.
I was doing a bit.
Yeah.
So I have stuck on the needle. That has served me very well. I thought I was upgrading towards one of the other weapons I had found. It was like some kind of hook. And I got to where I thought I needed to be in dexterity. And I'm like, I still can't use it. Why is that? Oh, okay. I don't meet the strength requirement.
Mm.
Okay. I got to up my strength. And I got the strength to where it needed to be. And I'm like, I still can't use it. Those are the only two requirements. What's going on? And then I realized it wasn't a dex requirement, which is one shade of green, the icon for it. It was a force requirement, or basically your stamina.
Oh, that's a bummer.
And yeah, and just those two on a you know, Steam Deck screen are close enough in color and you know, not distinguishable enough by icon that I had mixed those two up.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
At that point, yeah, at that point it's like, well, you know, I'm enjoying the needle still, and I've got a secondary weapon that's like, you know, passable. It's just a faster weapon, because the needle, as I discussed last time, kind of hits pretty slow but hard. And I'm like, you know, I'm fine. Unless I find something that kind of feels like an upgrade or a variant on the needle, I'm not going to be actively trying to get to a new weapon.
Yeah. How's your little rock buddy who just wants to be pretty doing?
He's in pieces.
Yeah.
which she seems to be relatively pleased about. I think. Yeah. I can't tell. The rules of this world still elude me. But yeah, every time he shows up on screen, it is a delight.
Yeah.
The one thing that I thought was really interesting, and especially as I was going through what I now know are these kind of like late game boss fights or, you know, side quest, whatever things, is I was doing pretty extensive customization of my power loadout. So basically, you know, once you've killed an enemy enough times, they go into your inventory, and you can upgrade each monster in your inventory to give you little bonus powers. So some are very simple. It's just like, oh, raise your max health or raise how fast your stamina regenerates. Others are really like interesting and weirdly specific. So it's like after you pull an enemy, you know, do plus 20% damage for the next 3 seconds. And it's like, man, I hardly ever pull enemies. Why? When am I ever going to use that? And so I focus my points on something different. But I noticed like, oh, you get a lot of respec points,
yeah.
The pearls of something. I forget what they're called. But basically like the game is kind of letting you customize your build to a specific boss or situation. And so the way I beat the Giant of Eyes, which is that really hard boss that, was in the wrong direction, went all in that pulling. Cause I noticed, oh, there's a lot of opportunities to pull this boss more so than I would ever see in a regular fight or than I've seen in other boss fights. And that's what finally got me through it, was just kind of all inning on the one weakness I saw, for the boss build wise. And then afterwards, you know, it's easy enough to reset that and get back to what you had before. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not for free. You can't just do it frivolously, but, for those sections, you really need that specialization. You know, it's a level that I'm thinking about Grime on now that I haven't thought about other Souls-like games on.
Yeah. Respecs should be cheap and plentiful. You know, maybe not necessarily at will, but like that is one of the great things about Elden Ring, you know, as well. Like, you know, they're 18 of those respect coupons, and that is about as much as you're going to want to respect in a single playthrough. Actually, no, much more than you would want to, but you want to have a little bit of a little bit of buffer.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it allows you to try something that doesn't work and not be screwed. But the interesting thing is, like, you know, I think respecking in other Souls-likes, it feels like, okay, well, what, you know, what's the thing my weapon primarily scales around? And I just want to have a lot of points in that. And that's as much as I've really thought about it. Whereas in Grime, the things you can put points into are so wildly varied that it feels like you can get very specialized in a way that I haven't seen in other games.
Yeah.
So that's Grime. I'm back on the critical path, I think, for now. No promises, but am enjoying the hell out of it.
Yeah. You're going to see some real cool stuff before it ends. And like, you're going to get, I mean, there's whole DLC that I haven't played yet. So that's, you know, waiting for you.
Well, and that's interesting. I have Grime. It's like, what is it called? Hold on.
There's like the,
oh, this is something fun I learned today. So I've known that you can use the deck to stream games from your main computer if both are on. Today I learned that I can use my main computer to stream games that are only installed on the deck.
That's I mean, that's not surprising because Steam is just Steam, but also why? Why would you?
I was like, oh, I guess I could do that. Well, I usually keep my list to only things I have installed. And I was like, this list is a lot longer than I'm used to. Why? And then, oh, it's because, you know, my deck is still on. So I have the definitive edition of the game. And it's unclear to me. I guess the Parting Shade is the DLC that just came out. It's unclear to me if I have access to that with the definitive edition.
I believe all of the DLC is just free. Like, you just get it. They did, like, the Blasphemous model. So.
Excellent. Okay. Awesome. Yeah. Another reason to like this game.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool.
Grime.
That is me.
And that's a segment.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where we ask you a question and you answer it. Dennis, what is the question that you ask the nice people?
Yeah, you don't get a second chance at a first impression. So what is the strongest first impression that a game has ever made on you?
Yeah, I'll get us started here with David. Wait, let me see here. No, that's top comments. Wrong. I'll get started here with Dave. We have too many Daves. Who says, Parasite Eve. The opening FMV was, at the time, startling. A mature-rated game from Squaresoft. It was one of the best-looking CG cutscenes of its era. Oh, yeah, that nasty-looking rat mutating in the basement of the Opera Hall. Fuck yeah. Yeah. Love Parasite Eve. And that was, like, I don't know, Square was selling whole games based on the quality of their CGI at that point. So
yeah, they were. Yeah.
Jala, what does Peter say?
Peter says, so many options, but I think the one that has stuck with me the most was / is Kingdom Hearts. That first FMV sequence was glorious. This was my first introduction to Final Fantasy characters, and that song, Simple and Clean, just the memory gives me goosebumps. That's my ringtone on my phone.
Simple and Clean is?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Yeah, I've never played Kingdom Hearts, and at this point, I'm probably not gonna go with God, everybody.
I only played the first one, so.
Yeah. Ben, what does Ollie say?
Ollie says, I'm sure I mentioned it before here, but the intro and loading screens of Metal Gear Solid on the PS1 are incredible. No game before and maybe since had made me feel as instantly immersed in the world as that one. Special shout out to Devil May Cry on how to introduce a cool character, Dante. Instantly felt like it. Like an actually fun character to hang with.
Yeah. Yeah. Just having Trish just busted on him and his, like, clearly the fantasy business that a 14-year-old would run. My motorcycle maintenance bar. It set a tone.
So I, my first Devil May Cry was Devil May Cry 3.
Okay.
And so I'm trying to remember the intro to that one. It is also him in a busted up wannabe bar. But yeah, good stuff.
Let's see. Sorry, didn't mean to yawn right in your ear. Dennis, what does Sean say?
Sean says Metal Gear Solid as well. I remember playing the demo constantly. The opening cutscene was so cool, and then getting to break some necks, I had never experienced anything like it before in a video game.
Yeah. Famously good demo, that one, as well for Metal Gear Solid 2. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Jeremy says, easy answer, Dark Souls. Played it for the first time when COVID started, and wow, that was a rude awakening. Real answer, Amnesia the Dark Descent. I knew right away that I was in for a great time. Yeah, Amnesia the Dark Descent makes a very good first impression, with hitting you with bunches of good and compelling questions with it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Jolly, what does David say?
David says, the prologue of Chained Echoes starts with that typical console RPG thing of waking up in your bedroom in your sleepy hometown, but literally slaps you awake out of that dream and drops you into the action with a strong narrative cliffhanger at the end, all in the first half hour or so.
This must have flown under my radar. I don't remember seeing anything about this. Looks neat, though.
So many people I know, including this particular person, they are very into that game. So yeah. I'm sure I'm going to play it at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ben, what does Greg say?
Greg says, hard to go wrong with Bioshock. That first 15 minutes of the opening and gameplay really grips you and sucks you into the game.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything up through that first plasmid. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And then it breaks.
Well, there's not a wasted moment in it.
Nope. Well, I mean, tons of people probably got introduced to libertarianism and thought it was cool, from the missing the point division. Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the arc of that game. Sure. Is like cool on the surface. And then,
oh shit. Yeah. This is completely impractical. let's see. This is you, Dennis, right?
Yeah.
What's Alex say?
Alex says, the thing that stands out the most that isn't just a pretty graphics impression is the first hour or so of Metal Gear Solid 5. Just a ton of absolutely wild and jarring and gruesome stuff happens, almost none of which is explained, and an hour in, you wind up fleeing on horseback while blasting away with a shotgun. It feels like it has almost nothing to do with how the next 10 hours of that game feel to play, or with the opening of any other Metal Gear game, for that matter. A very strong first impression, but also a bewildering one. I've always been a medium on the series, and I remember I had no idea what to make of it at the time I played it.
That's a very very divisive opening to a game.
I was going to say, retroactively feels very similar to Death Stranding.
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
I mean, just in terms of, you know, big swings.
Random shit being thrown at you.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very broad imagery. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see, and I'll wrap us up here with David, who says, I first thought of some recent things. The Baldur's Gate 3 opening cutscene and the Fallout 4 intro/tutorial. But I would rather answer with something that opened in a game when I was young. The opening song from Vandal Hearts kept me playing a mediocre game that I still own to this day. With the Metal Gear answers, I must include that Psycho Mantis would approve of this answer. Oh, that's right. Vandal Hearts is Konami, isn't it? Yeah. Vandal Hearts isn't the one that you play, Jella. That's Azure Dreams. Azure Dreams. Okay, mm-hmm. Sorry.
Also a Konami thing, but not that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I could have sworn that somebody would have given my answer on this. I'm going to say Mass Effect 2. That opening with the Normandy being destroyed, into it not knowing what to expect at all. At the time, especially, was like, okay. not a first impression because it's the second entry in a series. But, here we are. I'm going to give a runner-up answer on this. I know I rarely do. But the weird little attract mode for the PlayStation 1 RPG Wild Arms, which was some of the first anime I ever saw. I think I was a Sailor Moon fan at that point. But anime of the characters you know, never shown again in the game, set to what is very clearly just a straight up ripoff of an Ennio Morricone song from The Good and the Bad and the Ugly. I would just like let that thing play over and over again because it was so cool.
Yeah.
Jala.
So I've got a few because I wanted to pick stuff from different eras. So the first one I could think of was The Legend of Zelda, just the title screen music and the scroll of like how it tells you the whole basic setup of the story and shows you all the items and stuff you can pick up. Mm-hmm. Like, I know that's nonsense, but like I really did when I first rented that game, just sit and listen to the music and watch the title screen and go through that whole thing at least like 3 times before I played it at any given point, every single time I played it. So, and I still will, like if I ever load that game up, I have to sit there and listen to the whole thing before I go on. So, another one that's similar is the beginning of Lunar the Silver Star on the Sega CD, because that was the first time that I saw something that was that animated. Like, I know there had been stuff that had been released that had that level of animation on other systems I didn't own, but Lunar the Silver Star was the first time that I saw something that had like this, you know, music video opening with like, you know, here's all the characters and they're all actually animated rather than just being like still frames and stuff like you would get on the older systems. And you know, like that song that was in the North American release of that game, Fighting Through the Darkness, is super facepalmy, like, yeah, I don't know, 80s rock ballad kind of stuff. But like, I was embarrassed, but I couldn't stop watching it before I even went to play the game. So that there's that. But then like something that actually had the gameplay that, you know, got me interested in the game before I even got further was the Resident Evil 6 solo prologue that you have to play. And you only ever play it that first time that you play the game. And then after that, it just goes to the title screen from there. But like that first part where, you know, a lot of stuff has gone down and you're actually playing a little snippet from the very end of the game, or like, you know, like a retelling of the part of the end of the game, is really cool, especially like when you see it again later on in the game, once you've been playing through. And in my case, like I've never played it solo. I've always played it with somebody. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was cool to have just like that solo experience before getting into a co-op.
Yeah. They knew what they were doing by having you play as Leon for that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Ben, how about you?
Yeah, I wanted to go with like a more non-traditional answer, or games that I have already said for other ones. I wanted to go with a different game than that. So I think Gears of War was one where it just hit me where I played it, I think, my freshman year of college. And it was like I hadn't seen another game like it, and saw somebody play the first like 30 minutes to an hour of it and was pretty hooked on it after that. So, yeah.
Yeah. I forget what happens in the opening of that.
I mean, nothing drastic. It's like a prison breaks the first level, but like combination of like using the laser to kill the boss and like the light level at night, like things like that. It's just like a lot of really cool ideas all packed into
it. I mean, that was the first true stop and pop shooter as well. So just like, oh, there's a new way to interact with the game world as a character is pretty alluring.
Yeah, I think they had like a pretty robust cover system that was kind of innovative at the time.
And gray was cool. Corridors were cool.
Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, I flipped through a bunch of openings of games in my mind. I think where I'm going to land is The Last of Us.
Okay.
Yeah, jumping in and playing the beginning of the invasion as Joel, and you know how that all plays out. Specifically just the way it ends and then jumps forward. You know, I think there's a route you could have gone where, you know, Joel losing his daughter is kind of hidden or something he doesn't open up about, and then you do it as a later game reveal. But I think putting it up front like that was absolutely the right choice, and having you play through it like that was absolutely the right choice.
History bears out.
Yeah. I also, it's funny, I originally, when thinking of this question, was like, oh man, you know, the no Russian level from Modern Warfare 2 was just so, you know, smack you in the face. Cannot believe, don't know how to interact. Like, man, that set the tone of the game and the discourse around games for years after. But then I realized, oh, that's like four missions in.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. That's what everybody thinks about with that, but you don't,
Yeah, so that one's disqualified with the first impression rule.
It's, but, it's like, oh, Halo, Pillar of Autumn, that was an amazing opening level.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so that's me.
Cool. Yeah, well, thank you, everybody, for responding. If you would like to participate in these, go to the Duckfeed Community group on Facebook and watch the prompts to go up on Monday afternoons. Thank you, Dennis, for posting it.
Mm-hmm.
The end boss.
Now it is time for the end boss, where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games and how we feel about them. Jala, tell me about this museum exhibit.
Yeah, there is an exhibit that's going on in Harlem right now called Video Games, The Great Connector. And it's a free exhibit that is at the Harlem School of Arts, aimed at getting more people of color into technology fields, particularly game development, which I think is pretty freaking cool. Mm-hmm. And the exhibit includes interviews with game devs and materials to teach fundamentals of character creation. It also focuses on how to work in teams and also is a way for the younger generation to explain gaming to their parents and guardians as a legitimate career choice, which, you know, it seems kind of weird that that's still a thing that people have to explain to adults, like older folks. But here we are.
Although in this case, if I had a kid who was looking to get into games right now, playoffs. Yeah, that's but no, I don't mean to. I take your point.
Either way, various schools are making trips to this exhibit. It's also open to the public, and it runs through March 30th. This is just like a cool little outreach thing that I think is neat, because there is still like a lot of skewing towards, you know, like white male game devs. And so like it would be great to have a little bit more diversity.
Yeah. Nice. And a nice story here for Black History Month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm distracted because the thumbnail still for the video on this article that you sent, they're playing Pico Park, that game that we played on Duckstream.
The game that very nearly might actually be in the exhibit as part of that team aspect.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
Huh.
So they want to destroy any existing relationships that people walk in there with.
This is how you break
it's the
team
weed
up.
Out. Yeah, it's the weed out program.
We'll break you down, build you back up, break you down, build you back up, break you down, and time permitting, build you back up again. Oh man. That's neat. Anything else about that, Joel?
Nope, that's it.
All right. Let's see. I'm gonna end on mine because these other two are kind of bummers. Hey, Dennis, what's this nonsense about Tencent touching Elden Ring?
Yeah, I did not realize that they had bought a significant share of
FromSoft.
Yeah, there we are. Yeah, so I did not realize they had bought a significant share of FromSoft, but Tencent apparently owns a major portion of the company. Sony does as well. And apparently the machinations behind that are starting to become apparent. They are working on a mobile game of Elden Ring. And it seems like details are very scarce. I don't know if this is straight up Elden Ring on a phone, in which case, like, hell yeah, phones can do that now. So let's do that now.
They brought Death Stranding to phone, so...
Yeah. I mean, they did with the Resident Evil 4 remake as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, is this going to be Elden Ring reimagined as a gacha game? In which case, hell no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Got enough of those. Tencent has not really had a quote-unquote hit on mobile since League of Legends got ported over.
Mm-hmm.
Which had, you know, that was a really thoughtful and well done product. Granted, it's coming from a game that was already in the free to play model.
Yeah.
But the amazing amount of minor tweaks they did to make, you know, that game fit with a mobile interface, mm-hmm. While still retaining the flavor of all the characters and the balance, et cetera, was really impressive. So that was a good job on their part. Yeah, it's just, it's hard not knowing which way this is going to fall.
Yeah. My initial knee jerk is to say, oh, this is bad and dumb, but also how harmful could it be? Like, I don't know what they expect to find with this. If it's a gotcha thing, you know, that doesn't seem to, I don't know. Elden Ring is such a huge hit. There are probably people who will kind of seek this out, but also like Slashy Souls existing didn't necessarily help or harm, you know, Dark Souls 3, really. Dark Souls 3 was going to do what it did regardless. And Tencent owning a part of FromSoft, yeah, that's one thing, but they don't, it's not like a majority, you know, stake that they have in it. So they're not necessarily making decisions with the core product. So whatever, let them fuck around. Maybe it'll be cool, but I wouldn't bet on it. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I shudder and think like, oh, I heard the Erg Tree is dropping second stage millennia this week, so you really got a farm.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to be a match, but
no. You know,
have been wrong and could be wrong.
Yeah, well, like I said, straight up port. Just do a straight up port. Mm-hmm. Like, do something that's designed for phones that are plugged into the I forget what they're called, but kind of the controllers go behind the phone's back.
Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Like I'm fine with that. Mm-hmm. You do you. Get it on more platforms, but don't touch my baby.
Yeah. Ben, what have you brought for us?
I got a little bit of a downer story.
Yeah.
There's a documentary. There's two documentaries I want to talk about, actually. There's only one that I linked to y'all. There's a documentary released this last week by a German website called Game 2 that was about the day before and the game company behind that. Fantastic. And basically revealed like how shitty of a development cycle it was and how bad the company was and how toxic it was. Mm-hmm. Namely, the stories for it were... basically they hired a bunch of people fresh out of college, who kind of had little to no options of where to work. And they had different company policies, such as they would fine workers if they turned in sub-quality work, either if it was like game development or like voice acting or something like that. Up to, in the article, it said $1,900. And also they had a policy of just snap firing people if they found like a bug in their game due to somebody's work, which if you know anything about coding, everybody does that. Yeah, so it's like, so yeah, I don't know. So it sounds like super terrible. I don't know. Makes a bad story even worse. So
it sounds like bad writers coming up with an evil imaginary video game core.
Yeah.
It's like, no one would be this maniacally stupid.
Yeah.
Like, come on. But of course, you know, reality is stranger than fiction.
Yeah. Awful. I mean, and this is not the first thing that they did. It's the first time they got caught.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To cut against that, there's one other thing I wanted to share as well, where there is a 2-hour documentary that was released this last week on Naughty Dog and the release of The Last of Us Part 2. And that is a bit of a more heartening documentary, mainly because it kind of focuses on, at least towards the ending, how they've basically switched to a no crunch environment for work.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like something that they kind of have the luxury of doing because they, you know, sell some of the most popular games ever. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that two documentaries came out in the same week about these things. And they were very disparate from one another.
Yeah. Nightmarish conditions versus conditions that eventually got less nightmarish, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. I don't know. Crunch discourse. It's always bad. Don't do it. Not the discourse, the crunching. The crunching is always bad. Yeah.
Keep a cap on your discourse as well.
I mean,
just, you know, small bites.
Judiciously deployed, it can be wonderful.
Yeah.
I've got one, and this is the this is pursuant to me talking about the drum thing earlier. PDP, kind of the successor to Mad Catz in terms of making third party video game accessories, and also the successor to Mad Catz in making Rock Band instruments. They picked up after Mad Catz dissolved. They're doing it again. They announced to much fanfare the Riffmaster, a wireless guitar controller that is going to work with old Rock Band titles. They've got, it's like PC and Xbox, or PS4 and Xbox is what this is, or PC and Xbox and PC and PS4 are the two different models for this. So it's going to work with Rock Band 4 if you have it, and it is going to work with Fortnite Festival, which I played and reacted to and was not impressed with, but who knows, maybe with the controller it will be better. That won't solve the like drastic music library problems that I saw with it, but I'm willing to give them a chance. But
it's like saying maybe driving a car with a wheel instead of a controller will be better.
But this is just a Rock Band guitar controller, except it's got a little audio jack built in for if you want to play it with headphones. It has a rechargeable battery, has an analog stick on the back, as opposed to messing around with a D-pad on the front. It just looks like a very, very well-designed Rock Band guitar, released roughly, let's say, 12 years after anybody would want to buy this, except for me. I'm a sicko. Give it to me, please. Yummy, yummy. So I'm curious about it. Right now, the only guitar controller that I have that will work with Rock Band 4 is an old Guitar Hero 5 controller that I got at a Goodwill for $3. And so it'd be nice to have like a new and shiny one. No price or release has been announced for it, but I desperately hope, you know, I I'm just sitting around waiting for Disco to come back, baby. You know, big plastic controller based rhythm games are going to come back. And then now who's holding all the cards? I never gave them up.
Holding all the clicky thingies.
Yeah.
Two things. First off, you said they announced too much fanfare. And I was like, oh no, what bad thing happened?
No.
They got themselves overhyped. So misheard that. I understand now it's too much fanfare.
Yes.
And then two, the idea of the D-pad being on the back is causing me way too much stress. Like, what reorientation does it have in relation to the screen? Is it effectively like rotated around the X axis to get on the back, or on the Z axis? Or like, what are we talking about here? Cause this is scary.
The stakes are low for figuring it out. It's mostly for menu navigation.
Yeah, no, I am a novelty. I beat Halo on Legendary with a Guitar Hero controller player. So this is very,
I think,
important.
You got bigger stuff to worry about than the orientation of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair. Yeah.
I don't know. I just, it's good to see anything happening in this space, because you know, I'm frozen. I'm frozen in time.
It'll come back around. Yeah.
Cool. And that was everybody. I think that's everybody's story. So I think we should, how do we feel about bunting it
buttons
up?
Buttons! The credit.
Thank you so much for listening to level number 489. We appreciate you taking the time. You know what to do to help out the show. Patreon and Facebook and subscribing and telling your friends. It's all de rigueur. You've listened to a podcast before. Small programming note, no episode next week due to personal stuff, but we'll be back the week after. So have a happy Valentine's Day, everybody. There we go. That's the one.
Aw, there it is. Yeah.
Jala, what's happening at Jala Chan's place?
Yeah, so the current episode that is out as of the time that this episode drops is the Navigating Toxic Masculinity episode, which features Dennis and Simone.
Yes, indeed.
So that is available for folks like when this episode drops. And then the next episode, like, there won't be a level, but there will be Jalachan's Place episode on Dishonored. It'll be the first of two episodes. The next one will come out next month. So the first episode will be covering just kind of like general overview of Dishonored IP stuff, the games in general, what we like about them, etc. And then an overview of the first game and then the next one will be on the rest of it.
Yeah.
So.
Nice. Always down for some Dishonored.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dennis, anything to hype?
No, I guess, everyone is allowed onto Blue Sky now.
Yes.
So, if you were waiting, now is the moment.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, you can find me on Blue Sky. I've been Cole Ross. I'm on Blue Sky at Cole Ross.
And I've been Dennis Furia. You can find me on Blue Sky at Furia Games.
I'm Jellichon. I'm Jellichon in all the places I may be found, including Blue Sky.
And I've been Ben Merkel.
And stick around for some titles. Okay, who has titles?
I only have two.
Okay.
The Thinker, but for pissin'. And Everybody Hurts.
Ooh, okay.
Ooh.
Okay.
I have The Pisser. So
Little Pisser. I was close.
You had the Little Pisser?
No. I was saying my initial guess was close.
Okay. Yes. That's one that I have. Dennis, what do you have?
Oh, I've got two. I have Polygeist. One word.
Okay.
And then from towards the end there, Too Much Fanfare. But it's T-O-O, Much Fanfare.
Okay. All right. Ben, what you got?
I just have one taken out of context, and it's Left Me Cold, but I spelled it K-O-L-E-D. Because you said it.
Yeah. K-O-L-E-D. There we go. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
By laugh, I think it's The Thinker, but for pissing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Regretfully, but
yeah.
Let's inclusively.
Let's see. That might be right on the edge of what'll be like blanked out on iTunes. Whatever. That's fine. It's funny.
Do you want to preempt? Is it a legit concern that it might get filtered?
Not really. No.
In some way. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Sweet then.
Well, it is decided.